Hello and welcome. I am Tim Hutchings, and this is the EMS Podcast. This month, I'm super excited to announce an all-new sponsorship with our friends at the Backdoor Brewing Company. The Backdoor Brewers are thrilled to tell you about some of the innovative new brews they've got in store for you. Delicious porters, such as the Dustin Syrup Daddy, which clocks in at a whopping 12% alcohol by volume. The amazing chili-spiced Hot Cream Ale. Or how about the tasty Tickle the White Wit Beer? For those of you that like the sour side of things, try the mouth-watering
Key Lime Cream Pie
Goza, or the Goza right through ya. Stop by the brew house or visit us on the web and use offer code Snuggin' and Tuggin' for 10% off your first purchase. Backdoor Brewing is an independently owned and operated brew house. Please drink responsibly. So the way I start them all is, why don't you start by telling me who you are?
All right. Well, so my name is Tucker Kostich. I am currently the deputy chief of Brighton Volunteer Ambulance. Known you, Tim, for, going on 11, 12 years now, starting my EMS career back in 2010. I actually started, I guess you could say, my EMS career back in high school, junior year. The EMCC, which is a fancy way of saying BOCES, did a vocational program where they took juniors and seniors and said, hey, you're terrible in school, come do this. And I go, yes, this is a great way for me to get out of school, whether it be just a uncomfortable part or whatnot. So in my junior year, I became a CFR. In my senior year, I became an EMT. Had no clue what I was going to do with it. And then just said, you know what? What do I want to do with my life? And the answer came up with, I don't really know. And one of my good friends, Andrew Barbetta, said, I'm going to go work for Rural Metro. And I said, you know what? Sure. That sounds better than high school or college. Let's give it a try. So I started Rural Metro back in 2010 with not only Mr. Adam Evupan, one of your former interviewees. Was there for 3-4 years full-time, got my paramedic over at MCC. In that time frame, was hired on to Brighton Ambulance under the recommendation of one Lieutenant Hutchings at the time, health and safety officer. Owed to that. And kind of had been there ever since. Worked a little in Livingston County, worked a little in Greece, kind of did the typical EMS thing, putzed around the county for a little bit, but found home at Brighton and just been kind of rolling the ball there.
So you got your start in high school through the BOCES program. What was it that drew you into it? Like, not everyone that takes the class decides they love it and then it becomes a career. What was it about it that you liked?
You know, I was worried you were going to ask this question, and all I can think back is Mark Cohen's interview, and he had this really great story to what got him in. It was inspirational. It was great. And I literally think it was, I just was a terrible student. I was terrible in high school. I go, you know what? I don't like this. I was that kid that walked around wearing shaming myself back on this. I had corduroy pants, and whoever thought it was a good idea to make corduroy pants, and for my dad to be like, yes, my son needs to wear this. Corduroy pants and a hoodie at one point in my life. So for me, it was just an alternative, a way to get out of high school and try something different. And then kind of getting into it afterwards, I go, you know what? I'm not really sure, I guess, what college was holding for me, the direction I wanted to go. And kind of everything just fell into place. I said, you know what? I enjoy it. Let me keep trying it. And then I think I got frustrated being an EMT after a little while. And I said, you know what? I want to do more. I want to try something different. What else can I do? And I said, let me go be a paramedic. And since then, I hate to love it, love to hate it, but quite actually still enjoy doing it.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's interesting, because I had a similar, in that I hated school, and was not the best learner at all. And for us to wind up in careers where education is such a vital, important, or a vital aspect of what we do, is kind of funny. How did you manage making it through those classes? Even the EMT class isn't very straightforward. There is some studying involved. Did it get your attention and did you put in the work, or was it just kind of something that came natural to you?
You know, I think it was 50-50. I don't think it came natural to me. I fumbled through more than a few tasks along the way, but I got to give my hats off to the instructors. I had Delia T was my EMT instructor, and she was this funny little lady that lived out between here and Buffalo, but she had a way to kind of gain your attention and really attract you into things. And she was a great teacher. And then going into paramedic class, I absolutely adored Peanut Bonadonna. Peter Bonadonna. You can edit that part out.
Nope.
Yeah, that's going to stay in there. It's going to bite me. No, I enjoyed Peter Benedetta. He had a way of lecturing and a way of kind of captivating his audience's attention that really made you want to succeed. Something where he'd kind of give you the tidbit of information and without even knowing it, you'd look back and you're like, God, I want to learn more about that. And if I had looked at myself years past, I would go, I wouldn't want to look more into that. No, I really just want to go home and play a video game or relax. God, no. I would say there's some parts that maybe kind of came natural, just second nature, but they were few and far between. A lot of it was, you know, first man through the wall, always gets the bloody nose kind of thing. And it was just a learning curve the whole way. And I got to think that most of it was just the teachers that kind of pushed you along, that kind of educated you. I think finding an EMS educator is a rarity, but when you find one and you know they're fantastic at what they do, they have a way of getting this audience, which you and I both know we're terrible types of students, these very A-dominant personalities that dominate our field. We're the worst kind of people to have in an educational setting, but you find that special person that's able to capture that crowd and turn it around without them even knowing it. It's amazing. You can just learn a lot of things and kind of go from there.
Yeah. So you got your card. You went over to Metro, and that was your first gig. You hadn't done any volunteer work or anything like that prior. So Metro was your first real EMS experience.
You know, the saddest part is I'm going to incriminate myself here. I volunteered at Penfield Ambulance and Parrington Ambulance for about 10 minutes at each organization. I was I think I started actually as a foolish 16-year-old at Penfield. And they're like, you can be a dispatcher. Come on in. I think I did one shift and go, oh God, oh no. This is just not for me. And then Parrington was actually similar to the same thing, was I started there and then Rural Metro hired me. And it was you can't really play both here. Which way is going to help you out more? And I ended up having to go the Rural Metro route and said, this is the experience. This is the pay. This is the foot in the door to start the career. Cause I don't know if you remember back when you and I first got into this, the notion of starting your career in county medicine was just, it was obscene. It was absolutely astronomical. It was, you go to the city, you work for Rural Metro, you get that bulk exposure, you get that experience, and then you can come into the county. Cause it was the Shangri-La. You go to Parrington Ambulance and you're like, oh my God, ambulances that don't have holes in the floor. This is wonderful. Where do you find these magical things?
Yeah, it really is. It was, at least when I started, same thing. It was, you know, you went to one of the two commercial agencies, Monroe or Metro, which is now AMR. And then you would put in a year or two and then try to escape and get out to a county gig where it was a little bit more money and it was a little slower and you had equipment that worked and all that. But when I got my start, there was a guy who we both worked for named Dave. Dave Nolte was an incredible provider. And I remember he looked at me and said, if you want experience, you go to Rural Metro because 1 year there is worth three anywhere else just based on call volume alone. Absolutely. It's the shotgun, a blast to EMS. You're either going to make it or you're not. It's really trial by fire there.
You know, I think it's funny. It's speaking for myself, and I'm sure part of you as well. You look at where you are right now in your career and you go, I actually really miss those days.
Yeah.
You know, I really do. Lugging a Zoll E series or an M series up a flight of stairs that was no wider than the boxes I had in my hand, bouncing off the wall. Coming up to a scene to just get canceled or just be something completely else and doing that 14 times in 10 hours. At the time, it seemed like the worst experience of my life. You go, oh my God, I'm exhausted. I'm gaining weight. I'm stressed. I don't sleep. This is the worst. And now I look back and say, God, I actually loved that. I really, really loved it. I had some of the best times of my life in that city.
Yeah. Yeah. I enjoyed it a lot. And there are times where I think I should go back and do it again now that I'm a paramedic. I think it would be an interesting experience. Right. But then there's the part of me that goes, I don't want to run 14 calls anymore or sit in a truck all night. I like coming back to base and not getting my ass kicked. So it's a fine balance. But I've worked myself into a position where I don't have to do it, which is kind of nice. If I went back, it would be solely because I wanted to. But right now, I don't want anything to do with the city just because it's complete chaos to no fault of anybody. It's just a hellhole there right now.
It's tough, man. It's, you know, it's funny you say that because I came into this interview or this podcast with this preconceived notion that it's going to be this very philosophical debate of where is EMS going? Where have we come? How did we get here? And you think about it and you go, oh my God, how did we get here? What happened? We just had the biggest pandemic in the past 100 years. What is going on?
It is. We are certainly in an interesting time, and I'm going to dive into that a little bit more a little later. Actually, I just want to get a little more of your history here. So, you worked in the city. How long were you an EMT before you became a paramedic?
So three, almost 4 years. I actually took the longer route. They had the MCC program where you could do it in, I believe, 14 months. I took about 16 to 18. I was having a hard time kind of juggling between working a full-time schedule, living on my own, going to school, which my hat's off to anyone that can do it in the exact time frame. It is a challenge in itself. So I took a little longer.
It's even shorter now.
Oh my God. Those poor students. I don't know how they retain it all, but I took about just under 2 years. And so 3-4 years as an EMT, and then 2 years in that process at year, end of year three. So year 4 and 5. And then at about year 5, I ended up getting my paramedic card. Going from there.
And did you practice as a paramedic at AMR, or had you already moved over to Brighton?
You know, it was funny. It was Rome Metro is where I started practicing as a paramedic. And I still have one uniform upstairs, I think, that has the old Metro patch with a paramedic cert on it. And right at that time, they were transitioning into AMR. So I was at AMR for, it feels about a month. And then I just kind of said, hey, I can't do this, guys. I was juggling three jobs at the time. And I said, I got to cut one out. Mm-hmm. You guys are going to be it. I'm sorry. You know, bittersweet, if you will.
So most of your paramedic experiences come from the county then? And then at Brighton specifically?
Yeah, Brighton and Livingston County.
So we brought you over to Brighton. I knew you in passing. We never actually worked together. You were on my opposite shift, basically. So I had met you through basically shift change. You took my truck from me most mornings out in the middle of nowhere, Newark. So even as much as we loved the super busy shifts at that point in my time or my career there, I was on the slowest truck in the city. I wasn't even in the city. I was, 45 minutes away sitting on the transfer bus, basically. So I would meet you each morning. We'd shoot the shit for a little bit. I realized you were a decent dude. And I said, hey, we should bring this guy on board over at Brighton, because we were in the market for, like, we wanted younger paramedics, people that we could kind of mold into the what we wanted them to be at Brighton, who didn't have a whole bunch of bad habits already. So I remember going to our boss at the time and saying, hey, I know this dude, let's bring him on board. What made you interested in coming out there? Was it because it was kind of the dream of all city medics at the time, was to just escape to the county?
You know, I think it was change. It was something different. And like I said earlier, I referenced the Shangri-La, the holy grail of emergency medicine at the time of our practice. And it was going to a county agency. for me, Brighton has always kind of been that a unique balance where it's county medicine. If county medicine, I want to say, make it sound like concierge medicine. It's this wonderful, grand old idea of, oh, the catheters, you don't have to reuse things. Oh, this is wonderful. But it was just close enough to the city that it was comfortable for me. I think we're all kind of afraid of change in our own way, and that's why our profession is where it is. But you were close to the city, so if you got that bad call, you're like, oh, okay, let's go. We're not going to be putzing around here for 45 minutes driving. But it was also that that difference, that change that I was kind of looking forward to, a whole new structure, a new idea. You know, pair that with the fact that you, and I'll mention your partner's time, your partner's name at the time was Lee Collar, and it was just great doing shift change with you, meeting you guys, seeing you coming on, hearing the stories. That big giant old 3049 we had with the flipper switch in the front kind of thing, seeing that and being like, wow, you don't have to do CPR on someone. There's two sides to ambulance. It was the idea of change, the promise of something different, something new. And I think that was the biggest pull towards me was Brighton. And God, it's such an odd organization because of all the years of fun, there's equal frustration. Any job you do, you're always going to have that frustration point, but I have not been able to peg down what it is with Brighton Ambulance in particular that, you always come back to it. It's home. And you're like, oh God, I found something that frustrates me, but I want to come back. I want to work here. I love this community. I love these people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, very, very similar experience. I mean, you know me, I've come and gone from Brighton a handful of times now, and I've called it my second home. There's something about that community, the organization, as much as it can frustrate me, I really enjoy a lot of aspects of it. And I've always kind of seen it as the project to fix, this is my place and I can make it better. And I think that's part of the draw, is that there is the opportunity to do that, because it's still a small enough organization that you can have some impact on the change, because ultimately there's 20 of us that are working regularly there, so it's small enough that if you have an idea, you can bring it up to the management and have some positive impact there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy to say that there's 20 of us, it's small enough. Not only can you bring these ideas up, but I feel like you can see them home. You can see the whole thing develop and evolve.
Right.
You think of these larger companies, they go, hey, here's a project. We really want to see it. next thing you know, it's changing 300 hands. They're going, oh yeah, this is great. Let's change it. Let's morph it. By the time you get that final product, it's probably not even close to what you first imagined. We're here at Brighton or these smaller county organizations. You get to see the process evolve. You get to see what you came up with implemented. Then you get to see it kind of go through that review process and change to even better or stay the same if it is kind of a perfect thing. And it's nice to see that. It's kind of cool. It's a good place to grow, I think, is a good way to say it.
Yeah. Yeah. And as a provider, the experiences are similar to the city in that it's still a busy enough organization that you're getting multiple calls a day and you're getting all types of calls. It's not just one type of job that a lot of county organizations tend to fall into, because we are basically we share the border with the city. We've got a huge highway. We're a massive cut through town. Everyone that goes through our town is making their way to a job. So you still get that wide variety of call types too, along with it. So it's another one of those uniquely placed districts in that you get a little bit of everything still.
You know, it's crazy. I kind of think of it as we're the burger in the bun, if you will. You look at the city is this massive, massive enterprise. That's where the bulk of your call volume is. That's where your population is excellent. And then to our south, you look at CHS, one of our fellow agencies, and they're the largest county agency by a magnitude of just their design. And then you look in between and you get Brighton. And it's this weird little sliver L-shaped agency that really kind of has its own odd pocket. We sit on this border of two Goliaths, two titans of agencies, and we go, oh, hey guys, how can we help? How can we fit in? Mm-hmm. And we've always existed. And I got to be honest, we probably always will. Brighton is a resilient little district. But sometimes you get pulled out even further in the county. I went to Ontario County the other day. You know, I can honestly say I never thought I would be doing that too much. Maybe an RSI request for some of those RSI providers. But as a paramedic, being like, I don't even think this is an EMS charts. God, do I have to change something on the back end now? Oh my God. And that's, I think, the allure of it. That's what I love is you never know what you're going to get. You can go in every different direction.
Yeah. Yeah, you really can. You're at Brighton. You came on as a paramedic, and then shortly thereafter, you got promoted into an officer role. You actually took my spot as the safety officer when I got promoted.
Actually, I came in as an EMT, if you can believe it.
Oh, did you?
Okay. I was hired in as an EMT, and it was part-time at first. I tried three times before I got hired on full-time. Our now Captain Jen Myers and our former Captain Jimmy Nesbitt actually were the two full-time hires that got a job before me. And I was brought on part-time by a paramedic by the name of John Smith, our former DO, or Captain America, however you look at him. And I was just the guy that kept coming back, kept going, I want more punishment, come on, please let me on full-time, please let me on full-time. And it was two night shifts, actually, before I did come on full-time and get a officer position and become a paramedic, relieving you, actually.
Yeah. Oh, I had forgotten that. I thought you were on full-time right from the start. So you moved into the management side of things, and you've been there ever since. What was the draw towards being an officer?
You know, it's tricky. It's one of those things where I love the idea of operations, that big giant explosion you see on TV. There's cars and calls and ambulances everywhere, and you're trying to put some order to the chaos. I think anyone that knows me knows I have odd tendencies. I like things to be organized in their way. And I think that was kind of the appeal for me to get into operations was, you know, not only at the end of the day would I have a desk that I could organize quite nicely or clean on a routine basis, but bringing that order and stability to the chaos of a call and kind of having that option to be on scene, like, okay, you come in here, you come here, you take this patient. Something about, and I know this is something I never thought I'd ever say as an adult, ICS command structure, it just fascinates me in its own way. And I think getting into an operations role was kind of my foot in the door to see it a little bit more, to kind of get involved with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, ICS is I have a love-hate relationship with it, in that I love the concept, I hate the design, because I don't like sitting in front of a computer to learn things. So it's frustrating, but the core concept is great, in that unified command in theory should work every time, and if you actually utilize it, you know, and you do it the way it's designed, it's a really good system. So I like that aspect as well, bringing that order to chaos. You come in as the safety officer, taking over for me, actually. And then I went up to captain at the time. And then we kind of did a switcheroo again, and you moved into the captain's position when I effed off and said, I'm done with EMS for a while. So you're doing that. You're learning how to be a paramedic. This, you're a few years into Brighton now. You're 5-6 years into your EMS career. You're starting to feel comfortable. You're reaching that point where a lot of people in this business burn out completely and run away. What have you done to avoid some of that?
Ooh, tough question. Coming out with the heavy hitters right off the bat here. I don't know. It's really hard for me to say this was the one defining point that said, stick to it. Don't get burnt out. Stick to it. Stay with it. You know, could we attribute it to, I had nothing else to do. I was EMS trained my entire life. I didn't have any other alternatives or anything else. Sure, that might be one factor. But at the end core of it is, you know, like we said a little bit earlier, I cannot peg exactly what it was that got me into EMS. I can't peg exactly what it was that kept me in EMS. But no matter what, no matter how I look at it, no matter where I go, I always kind of step back and go, God, I really just love doing this. There's some appeal to it where you never know what you're going to expect coming into work. You can't sit there and go, oh, I got to do this, this, and this. I got to get that TPS report signed and on its way. It's the unknown. And I think it's the love of the unknown and that fascination, that kind of draw to it outweighs everything else. Because I'll admit, I've gone through my stances where I go, I'm burnt out. I'm done. I'm tired. I'm exhausted. Whether it be just call volume, patients, politics, coworkers, you name it, or just personal feelings, you hit that wall eventually. And then I think for us, it's kind of having that self-realization of I've hit that wall. What do I have to do now to either go around it or get above it? And no matter what, at no point in my time have I honestly said, and even right now in my career where I'm kind of looking at options of pursuing higher medicine, have I ever said, I'm done. I'm never coming back to EMS. I never want to do it, because it still has that little corner of my heart that always is like, you can't leave this. You're a fool if you leave this. You've been doing it so long, you love it.
We have a similar love of this job. I took a different approach in that I burned out as hard as you could possibly burn out and set some bridges on fire behind me and left the business for a little while. How were you able to, how do you think you avoided some of that though? Because it's not just love of the job alone. There has to be some kind of outlet there, right?
You know, and I think it's a two-part question, and it's two parts because I've been thinking about one part, and then the other one just kind of, this interview has kind of brought up with me is, we talked about change, and knowing your history, I think you're in the same boat as me, is at some point in your career, once you reach that point, you needed change. I remember when you left, and you were loving the asset management. You'd come back, you do a couple part-time things here and there, but you left, you got out of the game, and that was when you realized you had to come back, and you had to come back hard. So for me, that was probably, you know, going to Livingston County, working there a little bit for Rommel Kirchhoff and Karen Dewar. I was going to say her daughter, Catherine's name. But also then I went to Greece. I followed Matt Comer at the time, and we went over, we worked there for a little bit. And then I came back to Brighton. And I think having that change, seeing things through a different lens was really interesting. It was really unique and almost rejuvenating. It didn't last its entirety. It wasn't a change enough to be like, wow, I'm getting a complete refresh. But kind of seeing medicine through a different lens and from a different angle recharges the battery pack, if you will, to come back to somewhere that you know you want to be at and say, hey, I have a few different ideas. I saw a few different things that I really loved. Can we implement them here? And I think 90% of that then comes down to, if you have a place you call home in the management structure or just your coworkers support you enough, they'll say, yeah, let's look at this. Can we do it better? Sure. You know, so I think just changing a little bit, kind of having that ability to go a little bit of everywhere, which is, I guess, a good thing, but also a bad thing if we look at it. You know, we have issues where, you know, you say, I don't like something, I'm just going to go somewhere else, instead of just saying, hey, let's fix it. Let's try to find a way to make it better, because it's one big entity. So, yeah, I think that's honestly what kept me alive, was having that ability to change, whether it be changing roles, ranks, title, position, or trying to go to another agency for a little time and just working with a few new people. And I got to admit, going over to Greece in particular, I met some fantastic people. I had a lot of fun. I had a lot of frustration, but it was a great eye opener to kind of get a new experience of management and then come back and say, God, I've had a stick up my ass this entire time. I can be doing things so much better as a manager. Let's have some fun with this.
Yeah.
Edit that out. I don't know.
So breaking away from your home and then seeing some of the outside world really helped put things into perspective for you. You're still seeing awful things in this job on a regular basis. And you're a younger guy in this business. You haven't really known anything else outside of EMS when it comes to what work should be like. you're a new-ish paramedic at the time, and it's a lot. It can be overwhelming. How have you avoided some of the common trappings of EMS in your social lives? You know, you got into EMS and you're loving it and you're having a great time, but it's super easy to go home and drink it all away or drug it all away or party a little too hard. And you've, for the most part, have avoided a lot of those trappings. How do you think you manage the social aspect of the job?
I think I hit a few very well. I'll never forget Monday nights with some of the Brighton team going over and just having drinks at a local bar called Dragonfly. They had a little mini pizza and $6 Wells beverage night. So every Monday we'd go do that. And that was a great event. That was a great way out. But, you know, it's funny. I look back and I think I can speak for both of us when I say we had this phase in our career where you left work and you still had on a shirt that said, you know, EMS or fire, or you were part of another organization. You volunteered your time. It kind of consumed you. It was your life. It was your soul. And what you identified by was, I am an emergency responder. I love it. I feel it. I'm part of it, even when I'm not part of it. And I think for me, I don't even know what the turning point was, but there had to have been a point in my career where I just said, no, enough is enough. When I leave work, I leave work. You know, I'll still answer my phone, still answer questions, help where I can, but I need to find some other way to identify myself, some other way to find a happiness, if you will. So for me, at some point in my career, I kind of said, you know, I love the outdoors. I love hiking, pushing myself to a new challenge. I got into running for a while, and Adam loves to show me a picture of me when I helped him move the first time out of Rutgers Street. And I looked sickly. It was ungodly skinny. I think it was 150 pounds at that time, 54. And I just look back and go, oh God, what were you thinking? That was not great. Just as bad as the corduroy pants.
A quick aside, there was the time we put you in a hospital and you were being intubated and all of us were standing outside the room as you were, the serious procedure was done. And every single one of us went, holy shit, Tucker's kind of ripped, because you never realized like how good a shape you were in until they had your shirt off and were doing these scary procedures on you. But I remember our first thought wasn't, our buddy is being intubated right now because of this anaphylactic reaction. It was, wow, he's jacked right now.
I have been trying to find a way back to that point, not having my clothes taken off while intubated on a hospital. But of course, that was an experience in itself. Just that getting ripped point. And you know, crossing 30 now and getting into the management's like, I go, oh my God, I'm never going to get back to that. What am I doing? I got to run and everything hurts. Oh, you know, I take away two learning points from that. One, never trust a vegan. You know, they might be super the kindest person in the world, but two times in my life now, one was my own family, for God's sakes, I have trusted a vegan and they go, yes, it's great. You got to try this. And I go, got it. It's delicious. This is so good. And then 2 minutes later, I'm going, oh God, everything hurts. Something so good shouldn't hurt so much. And then one time I ended up in a hospital naked. And
yeah. So for a little backstory for the folks that don't know us, we were at a little holiday gathering of some friends, and it was actually the last guest on this podcast, Colin Ryan, was hosting it. Him and his wife had gone vegan, and Tucker is just housing this little plate of cheese and crackers. Oh, and he's like, this stuff is really, really good.
Identify it as cheese. They go, you have to try this cheese. And I'm sitting here going, these two, Wendy and Ryan, they're just such great hosts. They have cheese. I know it's not a vegan thing, but that's so nice of them. And yeah, you're right, it was so delicious.
Yeah, it was. It was really, really good. And then it turns out this wasn't a dairy-based cheese. It was like a cheese cashew substitute made out of cashews, which Tucker is severely allergic to. And within about 20 minutes, we were hitting him with an EpiPen, and our friend Colin's wife was rushing him to the ER, which thankfully she was in a high enough position of that skipped all of the BS and put him right into a room with the best team of doctors, and he was in the ICU within about 2 hours, I think. So,
but I will say, and I'm happy to say this is a point in my life, that is the first and only time I've been at a Christmas party and I've taken my pants off. So I think overall there is some good to come from that story.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of laughs in the beginning when we thought this was just a silly little, like, oh, he's having a minor reaction. And then his voice started squeaking and things got really scratchy. And we went, oh, wait a minute, this is serious. And then I made it from Gates to Rochester General in about 15 minutes, I think. doing.
Yeah, we pushed the Batmobile to the limit that time.
There's a set of train tracks on Ridge Road that I still wince when I drive over because I got airtime going over them. I was doing about 100 miles an hour, calling John, our boss at the time, saying, "John, we just put one of ours in the hospital." So yeah, that was one hell of a night.
It was a night of firsts for a lot of us.
So back into the social trappings. You tend to avoid a lot of that. You've had some good social experiences. You got really into working out and hiking and travel. I know you've been just about everywhere in the world at this point.
Wherever I can try to. It's become kind of a second passion. And you know, it's amazing. You made a comment a little earlier, and I think we kind of glazed over it, but I've heard it in some of your other interviews. Like you and Shauna spoke to it, is a few of us are lucky and blessed enough that we can work this career and maybe have one, two jobs, but equally have that financial freedom, because pay is always, always, always at the tip of the spear of controversy for us. Mm-hmm. Or do we get paid enough? Do we sustain enough? And to say that we're financially independent enough to do these things is kind of a blessing in its own disguise. So yeah, budget travel, I think, has been the key for me, is trying to go wherever I can and then finding a tent and saying, this looks like a great place to live. I'm in a country called Iceland. Yay, it's cold, but what am I going to do with it? That has been a great relief for me, is not only just like seeing new things, making new adventures, finding new friends. I've seen EMS in other countries, and I got to tell you, it is the coolest freaking thing to look at. I get a monster truck and I'm like, what is this? And someone goes like, oh, this is our ambulance. It goes everywhere. And you're like, that's not an Irish accent, by the way. You know, it was the most amazing thing. And then looking back and being like, oh, we have a little tiny Mercedes. What? That's not cool. That's terrible. God. So it's been interesting. And yeah, I think finding those ways to kind of limit your exposure to EMS, to realize that there's an off switch, and you have to find it, or else it's going to devour you as a person. As if you can leave work, and quite honestly, leave work, don't bring it home with you. That I think is one of the key takeaways and an essential thing for us, is just finding that out.
Yeah, it was a big part of my like recovery process, and finding out exactly what it was that was bugging me. It was knowing that I only had to work one job. I could live within my means if I worked one job, and then when I went home, I was in a position where none of my core group of friends did EMS. Like all the people I grew up with, nobody was in this world. My wife, well, fiance at the time, girlfriend, whatever she was at the time, she didn't do this. So it was kind of nice. I could go home and just switch off the EMS switch, which is another thing that a lot of us are unable to do, because we're working two and three jobs. And then when we leave, we're only hanging out with the EMS people. So then you leave and that's all you talk about. You go to the bar and you debrief all your calls and talk shit about your company. And then it's this spiral of never ending EMS talk, which is just exhausting. And now I've gotten to a point where when I'm not at work, I don't want to talk about work. You know, I go to a gathering, or even if I'm hanging out with EMS people, the last thing I want to talk about is calls that we've taken. Now I just want to shoot the shit and hang out and have like buddy talk, you know? Yeah. So that was a big part of it for me. And I think it's something we could really do to push EMS forward, is try and show people that, yes, we should make more money, because everyone deserves to make more money. But you also don't have to work three jobs. You can earn enough to make a living on what you're making at one job. You need not have a Mercedes and not have the biggest house with all of the toys.
Now we're splitting hairs on opinions, quite frankly. See me ride up to work in a G-Wagon, and I'd say I'm doing something right and probably something atrociously wrong too. No, but you know what? You said something there that's really neat, and I think you hit the nail on the head, is one of the things I'm envious for you for is you have this core group of friends that just, they're not EMS at all. You can go hang out with them, Jim, and you can just kind of say, hey guys, let's talk music. Let's talk craft beer.
Yeah.
You know, how's work for you? What's new and exciting in the world? And that's awesome.
I think a lot of that comes from the fact that I got into EMS later in life. You know, my first few jobs, I was working at, you know, a music store, and then I worked for Verizon. So that was my life. For the first half of my like early adult life was all you know, odd jobs in random corporate worlds. So I had friends from that, and you know, we'll go out, and that's what we'll talk about now is our times at Media Play and Verizon. But, you know, it wasn't just being in EMS, and so many people start as explorers, and you know, their whole family was in this bot job, and then that's all they ever knew.
Yeah,
I was always the oddball in that, like, you know, I was an explorer, I was a volley firefighter, and then I got into EMS, but nobody else that I really hung out with did it. So it was nice to break away.
Yeah, and I gotta admit, I'm jealous. I mean, for me, and my perspective is, you know, getting into this right out of high school, that was it. That's how I met friends, that's how I knew people, that's how you dated. It consumed you, and kind of moving through my career and going up the path of management, I'll admit it's been one of the largest hurdles I have ever thought I would never have to experience is how do you take people that you grew up with, you spent so much of your life with, saw so many terrible things, but also experienced such great joy with, and then kind of develop that into a professional respect from a management perspective of saying, I can't do some of the stuff we used to get together, or I can't have those discussions. Know your forum, mind your decorum. That's my new favorite catchphrase. And it's tricky because, you know, 5 years ago, I'd be like, oh God, yeah, let's talk about this. This is so vulgar. It's hysterical. And now you're going to be like, oh boy, this should not be a discussion point to be had. as funny as it would be.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've worked your way up. You're now the assistant chief of the agency or deputy chief, I'm sorry. So you're second in charge of our agency. How have you dealt with that? That is a difficult thing to do where you've grown up with these people. You've become a good friends with all of these people, and now you're their boss. That's not an easy thing to manage.
It's
especially in this business.
Yeah, it's been a challenge. And unfortunately, fortunately, but unfortunately, our agency is smaller. Like you said, there's maybe 20, 25 of us working full time at any given time. There are a few people that I still do see outside of work on the occasion where, you know, we try to kind of have that unspoken bond of, you know, we can talk about work for a minute, but I'm not going to get into it because quite honestly, this is our time outside of work.
Right.
But a lot of my core friend group, they did work there at one point and they moved on. A lot of them are city firefighters or moved on to new career fields. So I've kind of gotten lucky by just the virtue of time that a few people have kind of branched off from EMS and moved on from Brighton Ambulance. It's tough though. It's really kind of a difficult thing. You work in an organization that's so small. You spend so much time together and you see such great and terrible things. Inevitably, the bond between us gets quite strong.
Mm-hmm.
You learn people's deepest, darkest secrets. You see them at their worst, you see them at their best.
Yeah.
And then to step back and say, hang on, I need to take a business stance and be the professional director or the professional deputy here. I have to bring you in and yell at you because you did something wrong, or I can get to be praised because you did something really great. It's a real difficult challenge. And I don't have the exact answer. I've caught myself multiple times having a discussion with people in public and then going, you know what, this isn't really a great thing to do right now. Mm-hmm. Just by virtue of what I do for a job, I have to stop. I have to excuse myself from this conversation.
Yeah.
And there's times where sometimes I realize that a little too late and I go, oh boy, shouldn't have said that.
Yeah. that was one of my biggest challenges. I like to shoot the shit with people, and especially in this small agency, it's easy to sit around the table and just talk about everything that's on your mind. And especially me, I can't shut up about certain things. So I would walk away and go, oh shit. As a boss, I should not have said any, as a worker, I shouldn't have said any of that stuff, but especially as a boss, I should have never said some of those things out loud.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've been in that boat once or twice, and I go back to the office and I go, all right, let's think damage control. What's going to happen from this? And, you know, the few times that you do actually have to deal with that down the road, you go, I made a mistake. And you just have to acknowledge it. And you have to own up to it and say, I shouldn't have said that, or I shouldn't have been involved in that conversation. But it's ever building. It's ever changing. You know, we live in such a dynamic industry that I think that's kind of one of those things that you have to look at, too, and say most of our manager corps came from the ranks of staff.
Yeah.
You know, they've had that exposure. So there's going to inevitably be some of that crossover, some of those mistakes to be had. And, you know, I think we just have to look at each other and say, okay, you said something you might not have wanted to say. You said something you shouldn't have said, or you've been involved in something that you probably shouldn't have been on. Learn from it, please. Yeah. Please learn from it. Don't make the mistake again. Leave it at that.
So that kind of brings me into something else. When I think Tucker Kostich, I think somebody of like extreme principle to like an annoying point. You have a set of standards that you hold yourself to that nobody in the world could ever live up to, I don't think. Where do you think that comes from?
You know, I'd like to think that you know, I'd like to put myself on a pedestal and be like, wow, he's just a great guy. Oh my God, he's doing that well. As I sit here doing this interview in a Hawaiian shirt and sweatpants, we found the integrity break right there.
At least you're wearing pants.
Yes, yes, yes. It was a debate that ran through my mind. And I said, you know what? No, I don't know if this is video. Let's make sure we at least wear pants. You know, but I think a lot of it comes from just this anxious little fearful child inside that goes, you have to follow the rules. How can you not follow the rules? The rules are there for a reason. And if you don't follow the rules, who knows what's going to happen? You know, something as innocuous as using a backer, that's always kind of a thing that's in the back of my head, is so many of us go, I don't want to use a backer. I know how to back an ambulance. I'm not a buffoon. It's a small van. It only takes once when you're backing up and you either hit a child, you hit a person, or you get hit by a car and you go, shit, that's my career. The rules are there for a reason. I hate to say it. I hate to be the stickler for it, but I find that maybe it's just peace of mind or ease of being that if I follow the rules, perhaps that will alleviate some stress further down the line. That being said, I also believe that if there are rules for a reason, especially given in my role, I gotta try my best to follow them. I might not agree with all of them, but we can cross that bridge when we get to it later. And if I don't try to follow them to that point of nausea, I'm just a hypocrite. Plain and simple.
Yeah, that was for me when I was a boss, especially. I tried to follow. There were particular rules that I was dead set against, but there were other ones that I always followed. The example I always use is like pandemic time now, or Ebola back in the early 2020 or 2012 or whatever that was. I've always sported a very long beard and I enjoy it. And then I have to now wear an N95 and fit test my entire staff. And I have to say, well, I expect you to get fit tested. So I'm going to shave, I'm going to go clean shaven and live up to this standard, because how could I ever ask somebody else to do that if I'm not willing to do it myself? So that's one of the areas where I was always like, if I'm going to enforce these rules, I have to follow them myself.
It's tough though. You want to wear that badge of integrity, and mm-hmm. you might sit there and be like, really don't want to do this. I don't see the need to it. But at the same time, you have to look back at the end of the day and say, what's the repercussion to this? If I choose to willingly neglect this, knowing that it's wrong, how can I ever look at the next person and say, hey, you need to do this, or hey, I'm going to write you up, or hey, this is a problem? Because they're going to look back at you and just say, you did it just last week. And the honest to God truth is, if that happened, I'd have to go, yeah, all right, let's be better. Let's both of us be better. And unfortunately, this is not sometimes the most forgiving industry and not the most forgiving community out there.
Yeah, we have long memories when we want to.
Yes, yes, we do.
So speaking of the industry, where do you see EMS going?
You know, it's funny that you even asked that, because I was asked this question not but a week ago in another meeting I had. And it was the context of, you know, where do you see this industry going? Where do you see this agency going? And it was a question I particularly had trouble with. My views on this have changed so much over time. Mm-hmm. There was a part of me that was like, I want to be part of the emergency services. You look at the bond, the brotherhood, the sisterhood of, you know, fire and police, and you're like, wow, we could have that. That could be us. We could have the pension. And the honest truth is, absolutely, I want that pension. Sure, sure. That's a nice security net. And now lately, the other part of me has gone the opposite. And I've gone the route of saying, you know, I want the higher education. I want that seat at the table of medicine with the doctors, the nurses, the PCTs, the LPNs, the RNs, you name it. I want to be part of that community. I want to learn my trade better. And it's interesting, because I think from my role and my perspective now, you know, I've kind of had to step back and say, okay, no matter which path we take, where does the almighty dollar find itself in this? Because at the end of the day, and I hate to say this, money drives everything. It drives your industry in any direction. Is without funding, you can't have new equipment. You can't have ambulances. You can't have staff. You can't take calls. So I can look at the municipal side and say, yeah, tax-based funding, that's wonderful. Then we can try to be more of the emergency service community. I look at the hospital-based system and say, great, maybe we can change our billing structure, get in network, see a little bit better return there, have that higher integration and education level. And both of them have their challenges. One of the funniest things I kind of look at is, if I had to sit down and assess EMS, and I'd like to think even from an outside perspective, you know, say what you will about America, say what you will about capitalism. Surprisingly, we did one thing really ungodly well, is we took an industry of medicine and said, listen, this is one kind of business. We don't want to encourage repeat customers, because that means you're having a bad day. You're hurt, you're sick, you're injured. you know, we give out these things. We say, give us a survey. So if we ever have to come in next time and you realize how grotesque that is, we don't want to see you again. I don't want you in my ambulance because that means you're having a problem. But we capitalized on it and we found a way to make this such a huge bubble of society, of insurance companies, emergency services, hospitals, air ambulances, you name it. And billing and pay is always kind of at the core of any controversy. You look at these hospitals. I think right now the University of Rochester is one of the largest employers in the city of Rochester. And that's amazing because so much of their division is pre-hospital and hospital-based medicine. It's become a Goliath. So it's funny to me to look at these and say, where do I think EMS is going? I don't have a good answer for you. We've been in the spotlight now because of this pandemic as much as any other healthcare worker. And still, I think coming out on the other end of it, or what I hope to eventually be the other end, I don't have any better of an answer for you because I'd love to say, yes, we're going to sit at the table of medicine as equals, have that right, and be there leading the forefront of technology and advancement and improvement to try and make our patients healthier, make the quality of life better. But then I also say, well, do we want to be the emergency service side of things? Is that the path we want to take? Do we want to integrate and do more training with the fire department? I think the final answer has to be somewhat of a menagerie of everything, is we have to find a way to take all these different paths and squish them into a ball and say, guess what? We don't fit in anywhere, plain and simple. And that's not a bad thing, but we have to take ownership to it. You know, I want the feedback. I want the follow-up of the hospital. I want to see how my patient did. I want to learn the higher forms of medicine. But at the same point in time, I also need to understand on the emergency service side, how do we fit into a command structure? How do we work with these fire departments, these police departments, and say, hey, yeah, I understand your operation. I understand why you're doing it the way you are. Let me try to learn and be better at that. And I think at the end of the day, one thing that we all need to take ownership of is education. It really is something probably we're not the best at because we all look at it and go, oh God, I have to do ACLS again in 2 years, or oh, I have to do PALS again in 2 years. But, you know, this is one of the few industries, in my opinion, that you can look at and say, the more you know, you don't make a better product. You don't say, wow, I made a better pencil today on the assembly line, or we made this new revolutionary design for a bicycle. The more you know, the more you can help someone else and you can save a life. And that to me is just this earnest of this highest calling, if you will. It's truly humbling if you think about it in its own right. And I guess tangenting back to, or getting off my tangent back to where you said, is I can't say I know what the direction of the industry is, because maybe I'm just as lost as everyone else in saying, you know, the direction I thought would be the best direction, surprisingly, maybe isn't. And the direction I didn't think we'd want to take, maybe now is.
So that said, then, taking away all obstacles and all of that in our utopian, perfect Tucker world, do you think education is the answer then? You know, should we require higher degrees or more education for our providers before letting them out in the field? Or is it something else?
I think, unfortunately, even in this perfect utopian world, the answer is money. Money is always the answer. Is I would like to look at you, Hutch, and say, hey, we need to have bachelors to be paramedics, associates to be EMTs, masters to be critical care. But I think it's difficult to do that and say, hey, guess what? You get to come in and $20,000, $30,000 is your starting average wage for an EMT, $40,000 to $50,000 for a paramedic. It's difficult. And I don't blame people for saying, I'm not going to go $70,000 in debt using this traditional education system we have just to come out in a field where I don't have a dedicated retirement in some settings. I don't necessarily have the opportunity to grow to the degree that I want. And that's not saying there's not growth in EMS, because there absolutely is. It's one of the most ever-changing industries I think I've ever seen. But I think it's tough because at the end of the day, no matter what direction we want to go in, money always becomes a factor. Can we get better reimbursement? Can we get more town funding? Can we just see different rates in which we bill? I don't know what the perfect answer is, in all honesty. I do think education plays a huge factor into it, because I personally find myself at a point of saying, I forgot a lot of what brought me into this industry. When I graduated paramedic class, there were some things that I could tell you that right now I'd have to look at and go, I got to look it up. Give me a moment. Hang on. I know this. It's in the back of my head somewhere, because you just don't use them. You don't expose yourself to it on a routine basis. And that's not a bad thing, but it's also not a great thing. It's something that I think we could do better at. And I would love to see some higher education, because I think at the end of the day, no matter what path we take, no matter what direction our industry leads, to me, our biggest failure is understanding. And that is the understanding of when I drop someone off in the hospital, what do they do now? What happens next? You know, I can guarantee you've heard the excuse, you got to have a 16 gauge. It's the only thing that can push blood through, or you got to have that 14 gauge. You really need it. And then you get to the hospital, like, I'm going to put a 22, or God, we're just going to do an art line. What are you talking about? You don't need to poke this person like a pincushion. And I think those kind of comments and those things come from just lack of understanding. So I'd love to see what the course of medicine is, not just from EMS and first activation of a 911 system and that link of ACLS command, but all the way through to patient discharge, patient DT, and getting back to their normal life. But, you know, I think it's a two-way street. It'd be nice if nurses, doctors, you know, even down to podiatrists knew exactly what EMS was, because I think we're kind of this great bubble of misunderstanding. We have so much to learn in our own field that we sometimes forget there's other fields out there, and some of those other fields do their jobs really, really well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a dream of mine. We started it at Brighton at one point where we would go out and just educate all of our offices. Brighton's a unique district in that we have every doctor's office in the world in our district. So it was an opportunity for us to go out and say, hey, here's what EMS is. You don't have to tell us to bring our ACLS when we show up. Like, it's just something we know. So things like that. And I think we started it and then it kind of fell apart, and it was, I think it was a failure a little bit on our end, and it was the community not fully understanding what we were trying to do. So it was a half-hearted attempt at a program that I think would ultimately be beneficial for the community at large to just fully understand what it is we do.
Sure. Sure. You know, and I can't disagree. I mean, as someone that ended up having to take over that program at one point, it's definitely something that even I'm going to drop the ball on, because it could be great.
Mm-hmm.
We do a farmer's market in Brighton every Sunday.
Yeah.
And you know what? I got to be honest. There's days when I'm just like, I don't want to come into work on Sunday. I'm sorry. It's the weekend for me. But at the same time, it'd be wonderful to just have an ambulance there, speak to community members. Hey, this is what we do. Come on, sit inside an ambulance, see what this is. You know, this is why we bring all this equipment. This is what this equipment is and what we can do. So, you know, you've been on scenes multiple times where you get there in the family, just go to the hospital. And you go, no, I can fix this problem right here.
Yep.
And it's a lack of understanding and community awareness. And,
yeah,
you know, I think that's something that we could do better on. But again, and I come full circle is, you know, if I want to have a paid staff member there, I have to pay for it. Is that accounted for in the budget? Is it accounted for in the payroll? Do I have to go in because I'm salary and it's not? It's tough. It's very tough kind of looking through the management lens, if you will, to kind of put your glasses on and say, how do we facilitate such programs such as these? And a lot of it is unfortunately turned back to, let's try to work it into the schedule. Let's try to figure out what we can. We might not have the finances and payroll this year to do 4 hours every single week for an EMT and a paramedic to go do a standby event, send an on-duty ambulance. Oh, they got to take a call. So it's tough.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it's something we used to do, and we would fill in with volunteers when we had them. We would send them over to the farmer's market. And then even that was just getting difficult because the volunteerism's falling off a cliff basically when it comes to those numbers. And that's not just a Brighton problem. That's nationwide. Nobody has the time to volunteer anymore, let alone give up an entire Sunday morning to go sit at a farmer's market. So,
right.
Yeah, it would be. I would love to see something along those lines, though. And it's a little bit of what I've hoped to bring out with just the doing this show is like, hey, here's a little bit of what it is we do, and here's who the people are on an ambulance.
Sure, sure. You know, I think, you know, it's kind of funny. We talk about this, and I think it was one of your podcasts. It's another podcast, and even my Adore said something. You've seen one EMS system, you've seen one EMS system. I think that's kind of also the problem we have to look at as an underlying cause is, we look at EMS systems across the country and they're so different.
Yeah.
So I can't educate one population and say, hey, this is how we do it. This is EMS. Because then I go 2 feet to the right and I get other agencies. It's like, no, we do this completely different. What are you talking about? That's not good medicine. This is good medicine.
Yeah.
You know, central lines for everyone. Give me a helicopter everywhere. Somewhere Adam's enjoying that comment. And it's difficult. It's so difficult is we have no standard for what is practice of emergency medicine true and through across the country, across the state, across the community, even across Monroe County. And I think that's one of the hardest parts is you try to educate people, you try to bring that community awareness in, and then there's just so much to it because we do things differently, because quite honestly, we can look at it and say, guess what? A heart attack's the same here as it is in Alabama, the same as it is in California. Sure. the idea and concept is there, but the demographic is so different. The people are so different. You look at the diet, you look at the attitude, you look at the understanding, the availability of resources, the options of hospitals. It's so incredibly diverse that that diversity, though a strength, almost becomes a weakness at some point.
Pivoting away from EMS in general, I know you do your hiking and you're working out and your travel. What else are you doing for fun?
Sorry?
What else are you doing for fun?
By virtue of this fine atmosphere that our listeners can't see, my girlfriend and I just recently moved in to our first house together. I sold my home in Penfield, which was a great thing for me. Moved into something a little bit different, started our relationship down the next path of it there. For me, it's been kind of doing that, just figuring out, hey, where's this relationship going? What's our next level? Let's go try craft beers. Let's take day trips around New York. It's been amazing. One of my passions, I love cooking. I really, really enjoy cooking. That's not to say I'm good at it, but I do enjoy it.
I'd argue you're pretty damn good at it.
Yeah, and the parts where you're really not that good, usually a bottle of wine fixes it. And it's amazing how your taste buds just kind of numb up quite quickly. I can't even remember where I heard it. That was the saying of, God, it tastes terrible. Just add more butter. Just add more butter. It's true. It really is so true. I think Southern cooking tells us that to the T. Grits look disgusting, but my God, you put butter on top of them and it's the most amazing thing in the world. Pancake.
I'm convinced butter. Nobody likes oysters. They like butter.
Oh God. You know, and I can't, you hit the nail on the head with that. When I look at an oyster and I just go, this is the ocean snot. Yep. No, I can't. This looks like a booger. I'm not going to eat this. And then you turn around and someone paying $35 for a single oyster is like, give me champagne. Now put the champagne on it and then put Tabasco sauce on it. Let's take the classiest thing and mix it with the least classy thing and slobber it down in a delicacy. Absolutely not. I enjoy cooking. And I think that's kind of a way for me to kind of develop a little bit of friendship and develop communities. I enjoy having dinner parties, having little sit downs with some of my friends group and say, hey, let's do saucy Sunday, fish fry Friday, whatever it may be, kind of make a joking innuendo to it is let's sit down over a meal, because no matter what, you can hate someone, you can be angry at someone, but you sit down over some good food and it is just a great, great thing. I always loved watching Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknowns, one of my absolute favorite shows. And I could find myself 2-3 hours into it, sitting in bed with my iPad going, working 4 hours, idiot, close this up. Because it was always that hybrid of, wow, I'd love to travel these places, Port-au-Prince. I'd love to go there, try the food, meet the people. And that's kind of one of the big things I've been doing right now is just finding a way for Irene and I to experience new things together, see where the next steps go. We're actually going to be doing some traveling. We're leaving at the end of the week to go see some family of mine in Boston. This will be the first time my father, which that's a whole nother story, getting him through TSA and on an airplane is a challenge for a man with anxiety of his, getting him to see his granddaughter for the first time. You know, it's a child born in COVID and he's never met her. So that's an experience that I think we're looking forward to and kind of getting back into the travel, which, knock on wood, maybe that's why I got this table. Fingers crossed we can kind of get over this hump of COVID to get back to doing travel, because over the past year, I can tell you that's been a moot point for me is, you know, we live in this city of Rochester. And I say, well, what do you do in Rochester? I'm looking at my mug here and on it, it's got a garbage plate. And I think that sums it up perfectly. You eat, you drink, you walk up and down one street again and again, and that's really it. It's not this giant city where I can go 20 minutes and be in a mountain range or 30 minutes and be in an ocean or next to another country and be like, wow, this is great. So I'm hoping we're kind of getting back to that sense of norm, which right now I'm sure is kind of a overly optimistic thing to say, but
unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope we do get back to that so I can find some of those things that I used as a, you know, ways to find some happiness, ways to get away from work kind of thing. And I'm looking forward to even just this coming weekend going somewhere as simple as Boston. Yeah. I don't like cannolis, but they make really good cannolis there. And I don't know why. Lobster, same thing. I plan on saying haba and lobster and wearing some khakis, whatever you decide. That's just something I'm looking forward to.
Nice. What about movies, music, TV?
Well, I think you and I are in this one together is Dune. I am so looking forward to Frank Herbert's Dune. It's I can remember in my childhood watching the original one and seeing Patrick Stewart in a still suit going, that is just the coolest thing. And then they put up their shields and they do their knife fight. And I'm like, God, that is the dumbest thing. And then seeing the next iteration, I think it was a Sci-Fi Channel miniseries. And I loved it. Yeah. I loved it. Seeing Baron Harkonnen. And then seeing the trailer with Dave, I'm going to call him Batista. playing a Raban, and I go, oh my God, I'm getting, you know, chest quivers just thinking about it. I'm like, this is so fun. So, you know, seeing
have
that.
Have you read those books?
I read a few. I read the Frank Herbert originals. I never got into any of his son's books. And I got to tell you, they are a difficult read.
Yeah.
They're so amazing at the same time. It's one
dense,
of those ones
you're going to read books.
Him and Michael Crichton have always been two of my favorite authors. I'm actually reading one of his now. God, I can't remember the title. I believe it's called Bones, and it's about an archaeology expedition out west back in the late 1900s. So it's really interesting. James Bond, same thing. I think that might actually be the first movie, pending everything going on with COVID, that Irene and I are going to go back to the movie theater to see, because I love Daniel Craig. I love what he's doing, and the trailers look amazing. So it's, you know, when I can find the time, watching some good movies, reading a couple good books, I find every time I turn around, I'm like, oh, HBO, new thing on the new Suicide Squad movie. Loved it.
Yeah. And yeah. It was a lot of fun. I really liked that. I was so happy they finally redeemed it, because the last movie was one of my most hated movies.
Yeah.
I was stuck in the theater seeing that thing. I had just broken my foot, so I couldn't get up and leave because I was on crutches and I didn't want to disturb this packed theater that I was in. But I was just sitting there steaming. I was so angry at that thing because I was so excited for it. So now that there's a good version of it in the world, I was really excited. I'm like, I hope they keep doing them, because it was a fun movie that embraced how weird comics are. And
the director, Gunn, he does it so well.
Yeah, like, he's got a really good way of just in embracing the strange while still giving it enough heart and enough just over the top violence that it's not any one thing.
Right. I watched Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and 2 earlier this week, and same thing. I just go, I love this. This director has a way of
making you fall in love with a tree.
Yeah, it's goofy, entertaining. Yeah. Diesel has 3-4 words that he says the entire movie, but it's great.
Yeah.
And God, every time I watch it, this is the weirdest thing, is it takes me back to my childhood. I tear up a little bit, because every time he says, I am Groot, all I can listen to and hear is the Iron Giant. I'm like, oh my God, that was one of the saddest movies growing up. Oh,
the Iron Giant. That is a great movie.
I go, you stay, no following. And I'm like, oh my God, Superman. it's tough. So I think that's kind of something I'm looking forward to, is the Dune series, because it brings me back to that childhood. Probably try and find my father and get him. I'll drag him into a theater, and I'm sure you and I are going to sit somewhere and talk about it for 30, 40 minutes and be like, oh my God, this was wonderful.
Yes, we will.
Yeah.
So, that has been high up on my list of most anticipated.
Foundation, I don't know if you've been following that. That's one that I'm looking forward to as well, on the Apple streaming service. They're not paying me to say that. But watching some of the trailers, it looks like another just great sci-fi epic that I'm like, this is good.
That's fantastic. An Asimov story, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's Isaac Asimov, and it's really interesting. It's this genetic dynasty, and kind of using a mathematical plot to predict the future and the fall of this great empire. And I find it funny, because you look at it, and even the trailers, they have it where, you know, the central leaders are like, no, it can never happen. It can never happen. But it's happening all around them, and it's that difficulty to admit, hey, we're failing. Something's going wrong. So I am super, super anxious. That whole sci-fi genre just, it's a fun one for me.
Yeah.
It's my inner geek.
Yeah. Don't worry. I know you got a couple concerts you're going to coming up here. What kind of music into?
You know, honestly, it's kind of funny. Before meeting Irene, concerts were never high on my list. I saw Disturbed at Darien Lake, and I left with such a bad taste in my mouth. Not because of Disturbed in any way, shape, or form. They were amazing. The music was phenomenal, but the venue killed me. It was a shithole. Just the acoustics were terrible. You try to get out, you're fighting with a mob of people, and I'm like, this $20 Budweiser was not worth it. What am I doing?
And there's something about people that get drunk there that they're only allowed to get aggressively drunk there. No one's having fun at a Darien show. They're all drinking to destroy, and it doesn't matter what they're going to destroy. They're going to destroy something that night.
Yeah, Rage Against the Machine. I don't know what machine, but I assume it's a toaster. So we're going to go see Blue October in Connecticut coming up here. Circumstance, we were there for a wedding the night before outside of Hartford, and Irene and I were listening to the radio, and they said, hey, Blue October's coming, check it out. And we're like, oh, let's see if it's in Rochester. And she goes, God, it's in Connecticut the next night. So I'm like, let's just stay a little bit longer. That'll be fun. And then after that, we're going to go see X Ambassadors in Chicago, who they are one of my favorite bands. I really do enjoy their stuff. So I'm looking forward to that. And the other thing we do is whenever we do any of these travels is food. I'm a huge foodie. Like I said, is I plan on going and eating a burger at the Billy Goat, having a deep crust, deep dish pizza in Chicago. And I just learned that apparently they're famous for an odd type of hot dog. And I'm like, that sounds incredibly processed and disgusting, but I want to try it. It's going to be amazing.
Chicago dogs are the best, man.
And I never knew this was a thing.
Oh, yeah.
I was talking about the Philly cheesesteaks, and then someone's like, you're a Chicago dog. Like,
you can skip that deep dish bullshit and just go right for the Chicago dogs.
It's burgers and hot dogs.
Deep dish pizza sucks. I'm going on record. I need to put this out in the world.
That's it. That's a bold statement.
Deep dish pizza is garbage. It's not pizza. It's a hot mess. It's a bowl of goop.
I feel like you better hope this never makes it to Chicago. This podcast is never going to expand.
No, bring it on, Chicago. I will fuck with that city all day long. They make shit pizza.
Oh my God. You know, I mean, it's crazy that over the past six months, one of the things I've been really dying to do is Canadian border. I want to go back to Montreal. I fell in love with that city when I went 2 years ago. Poutine. It is the worst health choice you can imagine. And it's just irresponsible. There's no good to come out of that. You can't eat a dish of poutine and be like, wow, I'm going to go work this off. I'll go lift and run a mile. Because you just go, you know what, that's a half an hour off my lifespan. But you know what, it was worth it. That's sweet gravy.
Yeah, it's off the end of your life. And who really needs more time at the end?
If I can make it a good 30, 40 more years, I'll be happy. Anything past that, I'm sure I'm just going to be a crotchety old man and just exemplifying my crotchetiness that I have now. So it's okay.
Yeah, I call everything after 60 bonus time.
Bonus round.
Yep.
Every day you wake up is a new experience. Just looking forward to getting back out there and seeing a couple of these concerts.
Very cool. To kind of wrap things up, I shamelessly stole this question from a podcast that I love, and I ask it of everybody. So if anyone's been listening for a while now, they know that this is coming at the end. But from the You Made It Weird podcast, I ask every single person, can you tell me a time that you laughed really, really hard? The caveat being, it doesn't have to be a good story. It can be as simple as you farted in church and could not stop giggling over that.
It's going to come with some background, and I realize
some
viewers didn't make it to the end of this podcast because then they'll never have to hear the story and be like, God, this guy's got such a weird life. And to caveat everything, this was not me. I was not the one that did this. Is back when I was early 20s, I was living off a Park Ave with one of my roommates. You know, we went out one night, we had some drinking, got a little out of hand. It was a fun, great evening, you know, carefree, and never thought anything of it. You know, nothing crazy. So probably about 2 weeks later, I come back to the apartment and he is fuming. He's walking around just mad. And I'm trying to figure out what's going on. I'm not poking the bear, kind of saying, okay. Goes and he's just kind of fuming. And finally I go, what's wrong? Why are you angry? What's pissing you off? And he just goes, I don't know who did it, but someone took a shit in my closet. And I go, what? What? And he goes, I smelled in my bedroom. I don't know what it is. He goes, so I started looking and I started digging. I'm thinking like maybe the mouse or something that passed away. He goes, I found a Tupperware, like a nice Tupperware, and someone took a shit in it. Even now, I'm like, what the hell is wrong with you? And we're going through the story trying to recap it. And he goes, you know, what disgusting human being would do this? The bathroom is 10 feet away. I don't know what kind of people we invite around. Your friends, because one of my friends. And then he stops. And he just stops mid-sentence. And I go, what? We're not angry anymore. You know, we're both laughing. I'm laughing at this point. He's furious. And he just stops. And he goes, oh my God. I go, what? He goes, but a week ago I woke up and I noticed I had to go take a shower after I woke up. I'm like, oh God, that's disgusting. And he goes, I took a shit in my own closet. I go, what? He goes, I must have neatly unpacked everything, taken a crap in a Tupperware, neatly packed everything back and put it back in a closet. And I just remember there had to be a solid 10 minutes of pure laughter at this poor man's expense just to be like, you are ridiculous and you have a drinking problem. Now that's all I can say is I've never gotten to that point in my life where I've done that. But to hear this story and look and say, God, I live with this person. What else is going on without my knowledge behind my back at the times?
I cannot believe I've never heard this story before.
Yeah, no, I'm sure. That's why I'm not going to mention names, because this person wants that to stay a secret for the rest of his life. And it was the most hysterical thing I can ever think of. And anyone that knows this guy, he's a very clean, put together.
Yeah.
Very organized, very tame.
Yeah.
But to think there was a part in his life where he took a crap in a Tupperware in his closet and forgot about it.
Forgot about it.
It's a terrible story, and I'm glad I could tell you a story at someone else's expense, not my own.
Oh yeah, that's great.
I couldn't stop laughing, and every now and then I just have to bring it up, and I get this death of a glare from this person, and it just, God, it makes me laugh.
that is just outstanding, and I cannot think of a better way to wrap this up than with somebody pooping in their closet.
I'm very glad that we started a very professional, talked about movies, progression of our industry, real deep insight, and ended it with, you know, I knew this guy that took a poo in a closet.
And that is EMS in a nutshell, though, isn't it? You know, it is the ultimate, the super serious followed by the extremely obscene and absurd.
You know, we said that you just can't predict what the future holds, and I guess that holds true to its finest.
Yep. So with all of that said, first, I want to thank you for taking the time out of a Sunday to come and sit down and do this with me here. I really appreciate you spending the time to share your stories and have this chat. And on a personal level, thank you for being a good friend throughout all of these years, as well as a good mentor. I know you're not going to fully believe this because it's one of my favorite joys in the world is just picking on Tucker and being just frankly cruel to him at times. But you are somebody that I do look up to, and I do appreciate your advice. And it is very nice to have somebody that I can trust implicitly to come to and say, I think I fucked up. Let's talk through it. And know that you're not going to judge me for it. It is just a very nice, comforting relationship that we've got. And I really do appreciate that.
Yeah, so thank you.
Thank you for this time, and until next month, we'll see you.
Thank you. It's been fun, man. Thank you for having me.